I'm assuming you're all here to talk about race and racism and to move forward. This is kind of, today is a bit of review, but mostly we're going to be talking about where we can go from here. It's good to talk, but it's also good to take action. Let's pray. Gracious and loving God, thank you for your presence today. Thank you for making us who we are. Thank you for your diversity in nature, in humanity, in all things, in creation. We give you thanks, asking your guidance today as we have conversations and as we seek your guidance to fear not in Christ's name. Amen. Amen. Yeah, the whole people of color, I've been using that term largely throughout these workshops, POC, people of color. And it's not to say that I have no color. I don't mean to whitewash myself. I've heard other presenters use those terms. We can certainly become more specific when we say Asian Americans, black. Is it okay to say yellow? Is it okay to say red? You know, you catch some truth in each term that you use, and you run into trouble in some terms that you use. People of color is not the perfect term, but I appreciate very much you bringing it out and saying, is that the best term? I don't know. What do you think?
How about non-whites?
Non-whites is one I've also heard. The thing about non-whites is that it makes whiteness the center. It kind of centers the whiteness, because everything that's non-white is other.
Right. Although if you go to a dictionary or a thesaurus and look up white and black, you get some pretty disturbing revelations.
In terms of symbolism,
yeah.
You hit the nail on the head there. And that's an interesting thing. Yesterday I took a pause, didn't so much take note, didn't draw attention to it so much, but when I said, I want to be careful with my language here, when I was talking about the Trail of Tears, it wasn't the blackest moment, it wasn't the darkest moment, it was the saddest moment. And language is important. And our scriptures are filled with light and darkness language. The one that we sung, 7:15 on Sunday night, if any of you were here for this Sunday evening worship, light of our cries, light in our path. That one? Remember that one? You know, it's a great hymn. I love that hymn. But what if we said something like, Christ is the darkness, shadow our light. You know, that'd be a different hymn. It'd be an interesting flip on the way we look at light and dark. Sometimes when I put my kids to sleep, when they were younger, I'd say, now the gentle, comforting darkness has come, and you can go to sleep. Instead of thinking necessarily as darkness as something bad and evil, and that is throughout our scripture. It wasn't intended to be a racial kind of being tinged by racism, but it has become that as we've created racism, I contend, in the last 500 plus years. Maybe think about how you use the words light and dark. Boy, this is a really dark moment in my life. I really feel like... it's a really black moment in my life. You know, what do those terms mean? And how do they create reality for us? Yeah.
Some old friends of my family, Baptist farming roots people who I guess would hold like very well-meaning but racially insensitive concepts and attitudes. Anyway, but I remember when I was a kid, when in the summer, I'd get tan in Minnesota, and this sweet, really wonderful lady would say, "You kids are getting so dark." And so, anyway.
Meaning
you know,
that it's...
Well, so, and it was never the sense that it was negative. Obviously, it's the racism is also what I don't know what I'm saying. I mean, it's like... We also say that we also think of light as good and dark as bad because everybody relates to the sun coming up in the night having a different feel. Not everybody. So then it's just that thing where just pay attention to what people say is hurtful or something. And it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who looks like them feels the same way, right? You pay attention, but it's hard to find a real rule about what...
Language matters.
Yeah.
Language is important. I'm not going to make this a big part of this workshop. But maybe think about the use of language and how other people use language and how they use light and dark and that kind of thing. I appreciate you bringing up the issue of what is the right term, lightness and darkness. All right, well, fear not. I'm going to start with a video, if you don't mind. And at this point, my students say, "Oh, Mr. V, not another video."
Can you hear me? There's nowhere else to turn. I'm desperate. I need your help. I can hear you, my son. I've always been listening. Are we here? It is I, Jesus. I heard your prayer, and I've come to help you.
You're not Jesus.
I am.
But doesn't Jesus look a bit more like...
Oh, I see you thought I'd be white.
Kind of, yeah.
Look, I don't know what to tell you. I was born in the Middle East 2,000 years ago. The Bible's very clear about that. It should be pretty obvious I don't have blonde hair and blue eyes.
Yes, sir.
Plus, have you heard my story? I was arrested by a mob of angry government officials and beaten for a crime I didn't commit. That shit doesn't happen to white people.
Sorry. You're not really what I was expecting, that's all.
Would you like me to fetch white Jesus instead?
Well, could you?
No! Jesus. It's just me. You want my help or not?
Yeah, I suppose so. After all, you're black or white, we're both still Christians, right?
I'm guessing now's not the time to tell you I'm Jewish.
So we come with all kinds of assumptions about to our faith. You know, and I wonder, what kind of images of Jesus have you come upon in your travels? You ever thought about Jesus as black?
I thought it was interesting that he had an English accent.
Didn't he? Didn't Jesus speak with an English accent? And the images of Jesus in our culture that are something other than, you know, the European Jesus are more rare. It's, certainly they exist, not to say they don't, but, you know, it does kind of set us to thinking. And I noticed, actually, if I can observe for a moment, when the guy had, as he was praying, and then the light came on, and then the picture of the Jesus, there was a little bit of chortling out there. I'm curious what that chortling was about.
Well, you right away, it was not what he expected.
Or what you expected.
No, I think the laughing was when he said shit.
Yeah, right.
Shit doesn't happen to white.
Right.
That's where you're laughing.
Well, yeah, there was that moment, too. That was that we broke into laughter at that point. And then, actually, he didn't hear the man say, and we don't know who his father was. And that's when he says, well, that's just plain racist. That's what he said right after that. You were busy laughing. All right, well, that's just a little bit of humor, a little pointed humor to get our time going here today. I hope you enjoyed that little sideline there. So these are the guidelines and agreements that I've been reminding you of each day as we continue to engage in respectful conversation, honest conversation about this difficult topic. Stay engaged. Speak your truth responsibly. Listen to understand. Be willing to do things differently and experience discomfort, or maybe say things differently also. Accept and expect non-closure and be confidential. These I've actually mentioned a couple times. All right. Yesterday, we began to understand why it's... Monday, we began to understand why it's hard for white people to talk about racism and define. Spent a bit of time talking about definitions of race, racism, discrimination, prejudice, and those terms primarily. And then looked at three types of racism with the triangle model. And then yesterday, we looked at what is on the walls right now and detailed some of the key points along the history timeline. I do want to say at this point, I made a mistake, and I thank the people who pointed it out to me. Yesterday, I said that the U.S. government has not apologized to Japanese tourists. Thank you. I love it when my students point that out to me. But the government has, and offered them some thousands of dollars, and during, I believe, George W. Bush's time. Offered an apology to Japanese interns.
Actually, Reagan's
time?
Yeah, and it was 20,000 per.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds like there's division in the masses too, because I got told three different things by three different people, but the apology has been made.
I didn't know what my stepdad got.
Okay, all right. All right, well, education is a good thing. Today, actually, we'll identify personal, institutional, and cultural rats. Susan?
What?
Can you go up to our chalet?
No.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I forgot the things. I might have to put off an activity I'm going to do right
now.
You
want the...
Having to do with the stick notes there on my desk.
The stick notes or the beads?
Sorry?
The stick notes or the beads?
No, not the beads, the stick notes. I have three bags full of different colored stick notes.
Oh, yeah.
That's
okay.
What I need.
Okay.
All right. Take your time. Don't run.
Thank you. I need it for the next slide.
All right. So we'll identify personal, institutional, and cultural forms of racism on the timeline. When Susan comes back, I have an activity for that. We'll use the posters that are on the walls now, and we'll explore ways to stop talking and take action. So the gallery walk will put off for just a moment. Let's go ahead and spend a little time with these two gentlemen. I've alluded to these two books a couple times. W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. Who knows anything about these? What do you know?
I know there's a debate between the two about post-Reconstruction, how people of color, African-Americans, should kind of seek to move forward into the future and gaining more education. I believe W.E.B. Du Bois advocated for education primarily and moving to cities, whereas Booker T. was more stay on the land, work the land like you know how to do, and reclaim that part of your heritage, I guess. I don't know, is that...
That's a great start, actually. That's more than I think the average person knows about these two. And I'm bringing them up. Anybody else want to weigh in?
And W.E.B. Du Bois won the conversation for the most part.
Because he lived longer, probably.
Yeah.
Quite a bit longer.
Yeah. Which can be considered unfortunate when you look at some of the great work we're doing today with urban gardening and development and all sorts of other ways of achieving success.
Yeah. The debate between them was fascinating for a couple reasons. And it took place because there, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it took place because people were asking the question, as we continue to ask the question today, what is to be done? What are we to do from here about race relations? They sought to answer that same question. 35 years after the Civil War ended, the war between the states ended, they continued to wrestle with the question, what should we do? At a time when some have said that it was the most violent time for African Americans in our country, the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, these two men were talking about what is to be done. My brother-in-law, who I don't see here, but he's here in spirit, introduced me to a poem, actually, called Booker T. and W.E.B. It's four stanzas long, and maybe he said it's best read aloud, and it might be a good introduction to these two. It's by Dudley Randall. "It seems to me," said Booker T., "it shows a mighty lot of cheek to study chemistry and Greek, when Mr. Charlie needs a hand to hoe the cotton on his land, and when Miss Anne looks for a cook, why stick your nose inside a book?" "I don't agree," said W.E.B. "If I should have the drive to seek knowledge of chemistry or Greek, I'll do it. Charles and Miss can look another place for hand or cook. Some men rejoice in skill of hand and some in cultivating land, but there are others who maintain the right to cultivate the brain." "It seems to me," said Booker T., "that all you folks have missed the boat.
who shout about the right to vote and spend vain days and sleepless nights in uproar over civil rights. Just keep your mouths shut. And do not grouse, but work and save and buy a house. I don't agree, says W.E.B., for what can property avail if dignity and justice fail? Unless you help to make the laws, they'll steal your house with trumped-up claws. A rope's as tight, a fire as hot, no matter how much cash you've got. Speak soft and try your little plan, but as for me, I'll be a man. It seems to me, said Booker T. I don't agree, said W.E.B. And that was written in 1969 by Dudley Randall.
What's it called again?
It's called Booker T. and W.E.B. So I'm bringing these two up as we're trying to move forward. What is to be done? That's kind of our question today. If you will allow me, and this is actually on the podcast that you'll probably be able to access in about a month or two, but I thought I'd give you a little preview. Just my own analysis of the polemic between these two gentlemen. Enter two prominent African-American figures, each prescribing a way for former slaves and the descendants of slaves to move forward. Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois recognized and experienced the struggles that black men and women experienced in the late 1800s, but they had different ideas about how to bring about positive change. Washington was born a slave on a Virginia plantation in 1856. By the time the turn of the 20th century, however, he was the most well-known black man in the U.S., hands down, and probably the world. He was 9 years old when the war ended, and he went to work immediately in salt factories and coal mines during the day and to school at night. In 1881, he was sent to help organize the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, turning it into the respected black university that it remains today. In 1895, at the Atlanta Expo, he gave a controversial speech that addressed racial progress and made his name a household one. The speech, known as the Atlanta Compromise, is considered one of the most important speeches in American history. It conveyed the message that black people should concern themselves with working hard to gain economic advantage and to accommodate to white culture. In his own words, "To those of my race who depend on bettering the condition in a foreign land, I would say, make friends in every manly way of the people of all races by whom we are surrounded. It is at the bottom of life we must begin, not at the top. Nor should we permit our grievances to overshadow our opportunities." You can see why he's controversial. In short, he said that black people should work hard, as he said, be congenial, and accept their unequal place in society. White society, this is my own commentary, white society loved Washington and made him the chief spokesman for the black people because he said exactly what they wanted him to say. Just 8 months after Washington's speech, the Supreme Court issued its landmark Plessy v. Ferguson decision, which upheld the constitutionality of racial segregation. Washington felt that races would naturally separate, so that legal separation wasn't necessary. The Supreme Court decision went one step further, however, by saying that public facilities should be separate, but also equal. As you know, the country moved forward into the era we know as Jim Crow, and those facilities became anything but equal. One can imagine, however, many politicians loving to twist quotes by Washington to their advantage as they institutionalized a system of unequal treatment for people of color that lasted for almost 60 years. Here, however, is Washington in his own words published posthumously. "The Negro objects to being segregated because it unusually means that he will receive further inferior accommodations in return of the taxes he pays." He recognized that unequal treatment would be the result of legal separation. W.E.B. Du Bois was one among many black activists who criticized Washington harshly. In 1895, Du Bois was the first African-American to earn a doctorate from Harvard University. And he went on to found an organization that later merged with the NAACP. You are awesome. Thank you. In his well-known book, The Souls of Black Folk, he levels this criticism. Mr. Washington distinctly asks that black people give up, at least for the present, three things. First, political power. Second, insistence on civil rights. Third, higher education of Negro youth. And concentrate all their energies on industrial education, the accumulation of wealth, and the conciliation of the South. In essence, he said, Washington was willing to compromise on political rights in order to gain economic rights. Du Bois was not. Negroes must insist continually, says Du Bois, in season and out of season, that voting is necessary to modern manhood, that color discrimination is barbarism, and that black boys need education as well as white boys. These two perspectives both reflected and influenced early 20th century strategies for gaining full citizenship rights for all people of color. Those in favor of an approach that favors self-improvement through individual economic gain, the perpetual theme of late century author, if you know anything about Horatio Alger, that was, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. People who are of that mindset gravitate toward Booker T. Washington. Those in favor of an approach that focuses on political empowerment, the demand for civil rights, gains in society, find inspiration in W.E.B. Du Bois. Echoes of these two perspectives can still be heard today, particularly in the mindsets of our two-party political system, making Washington and Du Bois very relevant still. I'll stop reading at that point, but I think, yeah, go ahead.
At least these different perspectives are ways to move forward also happened with King, you know, and Malcolm X, and those, you know, within the NAACP with their new softer approach.
Mm-hmm.
Our government preferred to work with the softer approach, King. So there's,
and they've had more of the pressure from
Malcolm X,
right?
They hadn't had more of the pressure. So there's, you know, anytime there's a need for social justice to change, that becomes the dilemma. Because basically, I mean, as it said, the powerful do not give up power without there being aim.
Mm-hmm. So if Booker T. Washington is accused of anything, he's accused of accommodating to the white power structure. That's kind of the nature of his controversy. Willing to give up, striving for voting, striving for civil rights for people who are underserved. And not even worrying about, as it says in here, he says, don't worry about the grievances that you've suffered, slavery. Just move yourself forward. W.E.B. Du Bois does not say that. He says, voting rights now, get people into political office, move civil rights forward. That's our goal.
That's ultimately kind of is winning that.
Mm-hmm. So you go with W.E.B. Du Bois.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and historically that's where it went too, because voting did happen. I mean, changes happened in different ways over time.
Yeah.
More so.
I mean, at the same time, W.E.B. Du Bois gave to civil rights organizations, kind of not out in the open, but we know that Booker T. Washington gave to civil rights organizations. So he funded people. He was quite a wealthy person of any color and well known. And so the comparison between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. is an interesting one. One can see shades of the more militant, let's get it moving along, let's not worry about accommodation in Malcolm X. And in Martin Luther King Jr., you can see I've got the Constitution in one hand, and I've got the Bible in the other hand, and I'm gonna try to talk nice, but you can also fire hose me and lock me in jail. You know, so there's some differences, but you can certainly see a difference in the kind of way that they go about it.
Well, King also did put that pressure on the whites, but not riding buses and, you know,
right.
going
right.
on strike, and so
okay.
they got their economic pressure
yeah.
from them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say that they were all exact, not at all, but just to realize that in any movement trying to push for change, there are disagreements as to what tactics are going to help to meet the direction you're going.
Angela Davis. Here's another name of somebody who probably would have followed the more W.E.B. Du Bois strain. Very controversial figure, I guess, in her own right, but she tended away from Booker T. Washington more toward a W.E.B. Du Bois. Let's get it going here, people. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I know what I'm talking about here, but if Booker T. Washington was about the accumulation of wealth, or at least trying to make that one of the principles that he was telling, you know, black people to pay attention to, a lot of people that deal with marginalized populations, that's where they focus attention, because in the long term, that's the only way big changes are made.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, having said that, you know, you can accumulate money faster if you have an education and you can earn more money, right? So I don't know. I mean, I know that, like, people that work with Native Americans in Alaska, that's the focus of their work.
Economic empowerment.
Economic empowerment,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to deny that. I'm not saying whether one of these is right and one of them is wrong.
Right.
I'm totally not going there. Because they both have elements of how should we move forward. They both got something going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I am thinking about what's right and what's wrong, and I can just because I tend to, but I can see from an individual perspective. For some people, as individuals, Booker T. Washington's way might have worked for them. But if I was in charge of leading the nation and making a strong nation where we're not wasting anybody, then hands down, of course. Everybody needs to have full respect and rights and choice about their lifestyle.
I know. And yet here's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with the more light touch, but he got voting rights to pass. I mean, you work with your context in a sense, and he was Booker T. and W.E.B. were working with the context in the early 1900s, and Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King were working with the context in the 60s and 50s.
I think that the lighter touch of Martin Luther King was more nonviolent resistance as opposed to violent action. But he was still very political and very much in the fray. Like he wasn't just, it wasn't a gentle thing. It was more around how to, violence or not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, just quickly, I know stories of relatively wealthy black people in the South who were lynched.
Yeah,
I mean, so you can get all the money you want in economic security, but down there, it really wasn't security. So.
Yes, I know. And so, good conversation. Yeah, go ahead, Dennis.
I was going to suggest, you know, as we listen to it as people of privilege, often I think we say, well, which one's the right answer? Mm-hmm. As opposed to, shouldn't we listen to both? Shouldn't we be listening to Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and a host of other leaders? Shouldn't we be listening to black flag leaders and the elders of the civil rights movement at the same time? And the fact that things don't line up perfectly, I think often people of privilege say, well, just give us the right answer.
Yeah.
Versus the debate that goes on. And I think that debate by leaders of color, we need to be listening to it. It may make it more uncomfortable to decide how do we become allies, effective allies. But as I listen to these two debates, I think that occurs over time and is important. So yeah, there's things that maybe we personally want to say, well, I clamp on to some of these ideas that they seem more rational to me, but isn't it not our responsibility to listen to both?
Yeah.
And listen to what people of color ultimately decide.
Right. And to give them voice. And you said the word listen. It's just an awesome word. It's one of the things I think what Robin DiAngelo brings up in her book, this White Fragility book. Listen is the first injunction she gives us. And you also mentioned something about the Black Lives Movement, that which has been heavily criticized for being militant in that. But, you know, it's interesting. Those people who criticize it for being militant, you know, is that W.E.B. talking? Which category would you put them in? Maybe a bit of both. But maybe we ought to listen to Black Lives Movement a little bit more instead of judge, well, that's got to be militant, because I really feel uncomfortable when I start hearing what they have to say. It's an awesome point. Yeah.
It's us white folk talking about what the blacks should do.
Mm.
You know, the Black Lives Movement receives criticism from a bunch of white folk. That's just stupid. White folk need to start focusing on themselves and taking a look at their own unconscious biases and clean up ourselves and clean up our own racist attitudes to set the stage for whatever Black Lives want to do, or this movement, or that movement, or that movement. Should be us white folks saying, oh, you should do this, you should do that. Oh, I think Booker is right, I think W was right, and you should do this. No, I need to look at my own biases and clean up my own attitudes and how I fit into the system of perpetual racism.
Yeah.
And once I clean up myself, then I have a better idea of how to clean up the system I play a part in to make it easier for people of color to take care of their own needs.
Great. Comment back here.
I think in terms of churches, take another picture we have in churches. In my church, we have no white Jesuses. We only have black Jesuses and people of color Jesuses, okay? And how inviting that is to others to come to our church, and what do they see in terms of how we relate to what Jesus might look like? That's a small item. Another item I'm picking up on in terms of listening, when our church supports and uses for the church to send me into Guatemala with indigenous people, the question that many of our church members said when we first went down there, I don't know, it's how many years ago, I'll say 10 years ago, that may not be right, it's 70 years ago, what do they need, what do they want, what can we do for them? Okay? And they said, we want you to walk with us. We want you to pray with us. We want you to come and visit with us. We don't want any things from you. That was hard for our church to take, that what they wanted to do was walk with them. They don't want anything. We tend to think of what can we do to fix this? What do they need? Do they need water treatment? Do they need wastewater treatment? Whatever it is they need, what can we give them? And we don't stop necessarily, as Dennis said, you said, to listen to what others need and want. And I think that's part of the biggest thing we can do is walk with them and listen to them and be there for them.
Awesome. And those walks are going to look differently. And maybe the least thing that those groups need is judgment from us about how they're going to move forward to overcome this thing called racism. We don't want to be judged by them about how we're moving forward. We're doing our best to move forward. Right? The Aboriginal woman who said something like, "If you want to help us, go away. If you want to walk with us, yeah, come and walk with us." Thank you. Okay. All right, well, Susan, thank you so much for bringing up this. I think I'll go back to this. On the walls, I want to do a little bit of review from yesterday. I've got three different colored stick notes. My intention in this activity is to really reinforce in our minds not just that racism is personal, which it is, but it's also institutional and it's cultural, that it is all three. That sometimes it's two things going on at the same time. But I'd like you to spend a little of the time, maybe I'll go 10 minutes, and we'll just walk around the room, start at any point on the wall that you like. Use yellowish stick notes and stick it right on there or above it, below it, to indicate where you recognize institutional racism taking place. Racism that focuses on policies, systems, laws, practices, that kind of thing, on an institutional level. And then the bluish stick notes, those are the cultural values and beliefs. What are the beliefs? Are there beliefs that this situation is communicating that communicate racism? I believe this. I believe that white people are. I believe that black people are. I believe that these races are. That's the kind of thing that would be appropriate to put a blue stick note on. And then the pink ones, that's for personal individual acts. If you recognize in any of these situations an individual act of racism, go ahead and stick a pink stick note on it. Does that make sense? Okay. So
maybe more than one.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, by all means. Yeah, you don't have to just see a pink one in there and just go over it. If you think a blue one goes where a pink one is, go ahead and put a blue one on there. So I'm going to go ahead and how to do this. I've got, the blue ones are smaller, don't be fooled by that. They work just as well. I'm going to go ahead and put these up here. Take maybe a stack of one or a stack of each one, and then start walking around. The table has been set. The purpose of this activity was to have you look, review some of the events that we talked about yesterday. And as you look around the room, the yellow and the blue have to do with cultural and institutional racism. Pink are personal racism. You know, which color is the most prominent? And I do this exercise. I mean, I could have put this timeline together any way I wanted to. I could have highlighted every single one of these posters with some kind of personal example of racism, and then the whole wall would be pink. But those didn't seem to me to be the most important events along the history of the racism history timeline. I wanted you to see how much yellow, how much blue has shown up in history, and probably still shows up. It's the thing that is the most damaging and the most impactful in terms of racism. Yeah.
I think they all work together because I think how they get, you know, the politicians are probably coming up with their ideas based on their cultural upbringing and their values. So there's the blue that affects the yellow. And then, of course, all of these things are going to affect individual people. So I say a lot of these are all three.
Yeah. And many of them have all three colors on them. That's a good point. I've heard people of color say to me that it's not the personal comments that I get. It's not somebody calling me the N-word. It's not somebody making a derogatory comment toward me. That's not actually, I can see that. I can touch that. It's tangible. The thing that I can't deal with quite as much is whether I don't know if I haven't been called back for an interview because I'm black or because I'm brown. I don't know. And there's this constant unknowing. It's a shaky ground to sit on, not to know. We never have to wonder, as white people, whether it was because of our skin color that we were or were not called back for an interview. But a person of color is never quite so sure because of history, because of institutional and cultural history. So there's a lot of yellow and a lot of blue on the wall. This is both to review the timeline and to give you a sense of how much cultural and institutional racism there has been out there and remains today. They absolutely feed into each other. People who make laws, people who have beliefs, are individuals. The comments, however, I'm saying, are less impactful to a person of color than the institutional and the cultural beliefs. Okay. All right, so how shall we move forward? We've already done these two gentlemen. Perhaps you've seen this illustration. How many have seen these series of illustrations? Okay, good. They're now making their way into institutions, into colleges and that kind of thing. When I went to school in the 80s, the mid-80s, we didn't talk about racism at all. And from the question I asked of you, how many of you had talked about racism before you were 20 years old in any school? Very few people raised their hands. So, but now these pictures are starting to filter themselves into colleges are starting to talk about racism, even calling classes the history of racism, or calling a class theology and multiculturalism, or architecture in multicultural perspective, or something on that order. It's tacked on to another kind of class. So I appreciate those of you who have started to see these now into, I'm assuming, did you do them at school, or have you seen them in some kind of training?
I've actually used them.
You've used them
in the street, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I forget where I first saw it, somewhere on the internet.
Great. Well, they're making their way around, because I think it's a helpful image. This is, when we're talking about the two terms, equity and equality, this is an image, this is the current reality right now, as I've been explaining. This is an image of one person standing on all of the gold, one person on some of the gold, and some people in the ground. Trying to watch baseball games. That's the current reality. Equality is where you give everybody an equal amount. no matter if whether they need that equal amount or not, or they even deserve the equal amount or not. But of course, this image kind of shows that you can give everybody the same number of rights, the same number of laws that are supposed to treat everybody equally, but in fact they don't. Where we are in society now is kind of like some people actually need a leg up, hence things like affirmative action. This is kind of an affirmative action image where some people don't need a box to stand on, while some need a short box and some need two boxes to stand on because of our history, our cultural and institutional racist history. That's not the ideal, though. This is the ideal.
Yeah.
Take the fence down. That's liberation for everybody. Get rid of the boxes altogether so that everybody can enjoy watching the game, so to speak. All right, anybody want to make a comment about this? Yeah.
One thing I find different between the equity with the boxes and the fence removal is that sometimes when we're trying to add boxes to lift people up, it's still institutional racism because we're trying to push maybe the primary values of like white culture onto other groups and give them the boxes that help maybe we think would help them, but we're not considering what barriers might still be there, and so we're trying to push that onto them and not let them be who they are, and not accepting their own differences and letting them thrive in their own identity. And I think that's another huge part of this discussion is letting all different groups still thrive in their own identity and seeing some of these different things like the dreadlocks and letting, you know, having that listening conversation where everyone understands that there are so many differences and we don't need to get rid of them. Like, differences are beautiful and we just have to find a way to take away those barriers rather than getting everybody to the same spot.
Could you speak to an example of one of those boxes that maybe white culture is trying to give to somebody, which they really kind of may need or may not need?
Well, I work in education, so I think there's a lot of things that we try to do and push on to students where we're trying to get them to conform to maybe one type of job or career or lifestyle when there's a lot of different opportunities that maybe fit with one culture better than what we accept as.
Yeah, good point. Thank you.
How about university entrance?
I'm sorry?
How about university entrance?
Say more.
Well, there's a big controversy over a recent court case where this white girl said she was discriminated against because a leg up was given to black girls applying to the college to try to make things equal and try to compensate for the disenfranchisement that they experienced in their lives and give them an equal chance in theirs.
Mm-hmm. Well, Betsy DeVos just weighed in on this very issue, not requiring colleges to necessarily pay attention to affirmative action laws. She's leaving it up to colleges as to whether they want to implement affirmative action. It's no longer a federal law at the higher education level. It's an interesting change.
I would suggest, you know, some of our language illustrates that. I'm colorblind.
Yeah.
So in other words, some would say, well, that I want to see the distinctions. But the reality is that you take away from people of color when you say you're colorblind. So what you are doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
It's what I want you to become versus embracing our diversity and seeing the benefits of those differing perspectives. You know, I think we discovered that it's surprising we still struggle with that when we think about how much better we are as we have more women in leadership. There's a different perspective. As we have people of different gender, as we have people of color, that there's something we pick up versus saying, well, I'm going to ignore you.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, I haven't heard from
it happens all the time in churches where we say we're, you know, especially as Lutherans in the LCA, we're, if you're part of it, we're open, we're inclusive to everyone, welcome to our church, you know, we want to include you or one of us as long as you like, Lefse and Lutefisk, and a smorgasbord, and all those things that we define as our own cultural Lutheranism, or a beer brought fry, or whatever specific culture it comes from, when really that's just not being inclusive, it's just trying to get people to fit into our mold of what we think Lutheranism looks like, where Lutheranism is so much broader than that and has so much more room. And if you try to mess with that, people really get upset.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, here.
The equality illustration the slides back makes me think about the backlash to Black Lives Matter, that all lives matter.
This one here?
Business. Yes. That just makes me think about that when there's that comeback to Black Lives Matter. Well, all lives matter. Like, everybody needs the same. And but it's just not recognizing that everyone's not starting at the same point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Black Lives Matter movement, all lives matter, blue lives matter, of course. Of course. And we've always said blue lives matter. We've always said white lives matter. But we haven't always said black lives matter. That's why it's important to say now. In a sense, black lives are kind of like, you got two houses on a block. One house is burning, and the other house is fine. Yes, of course the house, we should pay attention to the house that's not burning. But the house that's burning, that's the one that we should pay attention to. That's why black lives matter. I am actually sorry about this. I'm going to call on people who I haven't heard from yet, because I want to hear from diversity of voices. So not to disrespect anybody who said some things before, but I do want to hear and encourage people who haven't said anything. I say that's my speech to my seventh graders all the time. So thank you for understanding. All right, how should we move forward? Keep asking this question. We keep moving this question forward. Peggy McIntosh is a teacher, no longer living, she actually died a few years ago, but came up with a very interesting way to think about race and how white people are favored in our society. I'm not going to go through the same exercise I did last year, but just to kind of lay out a couple of examples. She says things like, I can be reasonably assured that if I'm not hired for a job, I don't have to ask whether it's because of my skin color. I can be relatively sure that if I go to the store and buy a box of Band-Aids, it's going to match my skin color. Things like that. She comes up with a whole list of things, a whole host of things that kind of show that white people are favored in our culture. When she's asked what to do, what do you do about a system that favors white people so much to the detriment of others? It's great to say all boats should rise. But the problem with racism is that it favors some at the expense of others. That's why racism is a problem. And so she says, you can use unearned advantage to weaken systems of unearned advantage. We have that power because we are the ones who, many of us, have that unearned advantage. I don't deserve the advantages I've gotten. I have been given them because of my skin color. But I also have the power to use that unearned advantage to dismantle systems of unearned advantage. And that's what she would say. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time, not much time, but I'm going to do three rounds of about maybe a couple minutes each, maybe 2 minutes each. Round one, maybe talk to some person next to you and ask the question, what are one or more ways in which you've had unearned disadvantage in your life?
Disadvantage.
We'll start the rooster crowing in about 2 minutes.
So, if I straight, you spoke educated, and you spoke family middle class, we just be able to distribute for I'm
Unearned disadvantage. Oftentimes, when I'm with a crowd of different colors, I'll ask a crowd that's primarily white, what are some examples of unearned disadvantage? And there's the usual unearned disadvantage. How do I talk about that? Was that easy? Did you get going after a while, or was it kind of hard to start the engine? Well, you know what's coming next. Ready? I'll give you a minute this time. Go. Breaking into your great conversations. I know they're really rich. But on that question, of course, maybe it didn't take you quite so much time as, we've been priming the pump the last couple days. Understood. But that one maybe didn't take quite as much time to kind of think through. The question is, what's it like for you to sit here and talk about and hear about these experiences of unearned advantage and disadvantage? What's that like?
Makes life easier.
How so?
When you're getting unearned advantages.
Oh, okay. What's it like to hear stories? Or is it hard? Maybe I should be a little bit more specific in the question. Is it hard to start talking about unearned disadvantages? Is it easy to talk about unearned advantages? Is it, do you really want to be able to have a story about unearned disadvantages so that you can relate to other people with unearned disadvantages?
Yes.
A little bit like survivor guilt. You know, you're really glad you survived, but you want the others too. In other words, so if you've got the advantage,
right.
You know, you like having the advantage, but you'd like the others to have it too. So it's sort of, it's that dilemma. You don't really want to give up what you've got, but you want to help others. Then what do you do to help others? So it's that attention.
Yeah.
I have an example of unearned disadvantage that really made a big impression on me in college. I took a Black history class, and I think I was the only white person in the class. And they actually had an open discussion as to whether I should be allowed. And I was blocked from going into the library to study. And I felt scared. I felt everything that they probably had felt all their life. And it became very real.
Did you eventually take the class?
I did.
So they allowed you to take the class?
Well, the discussion in the class, they most agreed that I should be there.
Yeah, that's just, you have an insight that most of us don't have.
And that was at University of Michigan.
University of Michigan. Interesting. That gives you an insight that I think most African Americans have. That
yes.
That experience that you had.
I was actually scared.
I believe it.
I had a similar story. So in middle school, whites were actually the lowest population. There was, you know, blacks and Hispanics, and then there was, I guess actually there were Asians around us, but if you didn't act black or Latino, you'd get made fun of. If you didn't fit the two main groups, you'd get picked on. You know, similar to what, you know, what people of color would be in a predominantly white school. So it was definitely very interesting and very weird. Because in elementary school, I was mostly white school, but and I was one of those white kids who didn't try to fit in with the black and Latino, because I'm like, that's not what I am. I'm who I am, and I'm not going to change because of that. So I was relegated, and I wasn't allowed to hang out with anyone. And I had like three friends in the entire school because of that. So.
Again, you've got that insight. I don't have your insight. I haven't experienced that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just mildly surprised on the advantage thing, and it sort of occurred to me that the first thing that came to mind is I never have to worry, like when I call the police, that I'm going to get shot. You know, that's an obvious unearned advantage. But it got me thinking, it's like, I wonder how many of those that I have that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those that we just have no concept
yeah.
that we're aware of?
Most.
Yeah. And I mean, I've lived in another culture where I was the racial minority, so I'm similar experience. But it's, you know, here in this culture, I wonder how many I'm unaware of.
What culture was that you lived in?
Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a very proud culture, proud of its own heritage and race.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very proud culture. I don't know if Susan's going to go where I was about to go. We were in the Philippines. We lived in the Philippines for a year also. But it was interesting because here is a whole country proud of its race, but also lifting up us, lifting up Susan and me because we're white. It's a culture that I don't even know how, they may be conscious of it, but I wonder how many countries I could go to throughout the world where, oh, here's this white person that's coming in. You know, they invited us to come to beauty pageants and be the judges of beauty pageants.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'd be invited to speak at events because here's this, maybe it has to do with the honoring the foreigner, as you know, many, many countries have this sense of hospitality and that perhaps the United States lacks. But I don't think so. I think there was some whiteness going on there and some respect for me that I did not earn because of my skin color.
I was going to add something else about it, which is in the Philippines, they have hygiene products meant to bleach your skin. They think like that works. I mean, it doesn't actually work your skin, but they have soaps and deodorants and everything that have bleach in them, because their idea is that they need to be whiter, and they would admire us for being white, and they would follow us around the store, and whatever we would pick, they'd later follow, we'd see people go, oh, they pick the same thing, like that's what the white people want, so that must be the better thing. And like, just very interesting, they didn't even know us, and we were just a novelty for one thing, being a minority in terms of numbers, but wanting to do the white thing and be the white thing and hide.
So we've been followed around stores too.
I was just going to mention around, I've heard it said, and I don't know if that's this is the situation that in Michigan that you had, but I've heard those who are a lower power group say if they're in a group and they want to talk about an issue, they would rather, at times it feels safer to have nobody else of the dominant group there. So like a group of women, if you have a group of women and you're talking about women's issues, there's a place for only women to talk about that, and you put a man into the middle of the room, and it's like that's a whole different, yeah, that's a changes the dynamic. So maybe they just, I don't know if that's purpose of class, but maybe they just had a, they're like, we want a chance ourselves without another person that's different than us, kind of changing the dynamic. I don't know.
Did you have your hand up?
One of my white friends in Vancouver, Washington, who just really wanted to be support and was really interested in the subject of racism, and went to a Black Lives Matter meeting and was told that she didn't really belong there. Mm-hmm. And they directed her to a different group that's called
Join Us for Racial Justice.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And so she went there, and then she was just, but I just really want to be allies. And anyway, so later on, I went to one of these search meetings just to see how that felt. And it felt a little bit weird and uncomfortable. But the interesting thing was, the woman who was like the head of Black Lives Matter came to part of that meeting, and actually there was a black student, a college student, who came, and he said he was doing a paper on something or other, and he just wanted to know what was going on. But so this woman from Black Lives Matter came, and she presented the first part of it, which was more like history of what the trouble is. And then she said, and then she gave us some articles to read, and then she wanted us to discuss it. And she made her a point of, she wanted to leave, she was going to leave, because it was not okay for her to be that when we were discussing it. She wanted us to have our own time. And she looked at the black student and told him he should leave, and he said he didn't want to, so he stayed. And, but I actually think we should all talk to, if we were all in the same room, we might get more accomplished.
And essentially, every once in a while, and maybe not even every once in a while, it's good to have a white caucus so that we can get out our own issues around this whole racism thing. That has value. There are times, you know, for all things under the sun, if you will, maybe there are times for a multiracial group, but there are times for just an all-black, an all-Latino, an all-women group, and then maybe there's time for an all-white group to kind of get at its issue without another mediating presence in between. There are advantages to that.
Surge is actually an outgrowth of, is part of the Black Lives Matter movement. It's like the white arm of the Black Lives Matter movement because of that.
Yeah. Okay, good conversation. I'm going to start actually, okay. Should I show the video or not?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I will show the video. This is Jay Smooth. Anybody heard of Jay Smooth? All right, here we go. You've heard of him. Yeah, of course, yeah. Jay Smooth is a commentator, and kind of, you see him on the internet a lot. He makes a lot
of
comments on different...
Excuse me, I think, will you have a question?
No,
this is
okay. Thank you. Jay Smooth is asking, I'll just run the video. He explains this.
Race, the final frontier. No matter what channel you watch, no matter what feed you aggregate, it seems like everybody everywhere is talking about race right now. And when everybody everywhere is talking about race, that means sooner or later you're going to have to tell somebody that they said something that sounded racist. So you need to be ready and have a plan in place for how to approach the inevitable that sounded racist conversation. And I'm going to tell you how to do that. The most important thing that you've got to do is remember the difference between the what they did conversation and the what they are conversation. Those are two totally different conversations, and you need to make sure that you pick the right one. The what they did conversation focuses strictly on the person's words and actions and explaining why what they did and what they said was unacceptable. This is also known as the that thing you said was racist conversation, and that's the conversation that you want to have. The what they are conversation, on the other hand, takes things one step further and uses what they did and what they said to draw conclusions about what kind of person they are. This is also known as the I think you are a racist conversation. This is the conversation you don't want to have, because that conversation takes us away from the facts of what they did and the speculation about their motives and intentions, and those are things you can only guess at, you can't ever prove, and that makes it way too easy for them to derail your whole argument. And that is the part that's crucial to understand. When you say, I think he's a racist, that's not a bad move because you might be wrong. That's a bad move because you might be right. Because if that dude really is racist, you want to make sure you hold him accountable and don't let him off easy. And even though intuitively it feels like the hardest way to hit hit him is just run up on him and say, I think your ass is racist. When you handle it that way, you're actually letting him off easy because you're setting up a conversation that's way too simple for him to derail and duck out of. Just think about how this plays out every time a politician or a celebrity gets caught out there. It always starts out as a what they did conversation, but as soon as the celebrity and their defenders get on camera, they start doing judo flips and switching it into a what they are conversation. I have known this person for years, and I know for a fact that they are not a racist, and how dare you claim to know what's inside their soul just because they made one little joke about watermelon tap dancing and going back out. And then you try and explain that we don't need to see inside their soul to know that they shouldn't have said all that about the watermelon, and you try to focus on the facts of the situation, but by then it's too late because the what they are conversation is a rhetorical Bermuda triangle where everything drowns in a sea of empty posturing until somebody just blames it all on hip-hop and we forget the whole thing ever happened. What has happened to you? When somebody picks my pocket, I'm not going to be chasing him down so I can figure out whether he feels like he's a thief deep down in his heart. I'm going to be chasing him down so I can get my wallet back. I don't care what he is, but I need to hold him accountable for what he did. And that's how we need to approach these conversations about race. Treat them like they took your wallet and focus on the part that matters, holding each person accountable for the impact of their words and actions. I don't care what you are. I care about what you did.
So if we think about moving this train down the tracks, how do we address racism? What is to be done? Address the actions and the words, not the person. And this is kind of a basic concept for conflict management and that kind of thing. Anyway. But I thought I'd let Jason say it out loud. Looking at the time, I don't know if I have the ability really to go into a method of mirroring the concept, a comment that someone, well, maybe we'll do it just briefly. Somebody brought up the comment before. A racist comment could be something as innocuous sounding as, I don't see color. Everybody is the same for me. Now, there's a bit of racism in that comment. And so the mirror affirm bridge model says, what I hear you saying is that you don't see color when you look at people. I appreciate your desire not to see color, but I wonder how a person of color would feel by you saying they're not their color. It's just a way of kind of using, I hear you, what I appreciate is, and then flipping it and turning it in some way to make them think a little bit more. I don't know. You can feel free to use this kind of mirror affirm bridge model to affirm what a person's saying if they think that they're not being racist, but also to help them think a little bit. Yeah.
I think Willie had something to say and he got passed over.
My bad. Did you?
Yeah, it's a comment that I want to make. It's a very general comment. I'm not pointing at anything in particular. I'm not of this culture, so I've sort of been listening to this as some an outsider. And what I want to say is that racism is not only here. I think I've traveled a little bit around the world, and I think that racism, even in my own context, there's a lot of racism. And when racism is institutionalized or culturalized, if I can use that word, we who are part of that culture, or what we've called here the dominant culture, we get swept away into that racism and we tend not to see it at all. We tend not to see, not to feel it, we tend not to think about it. I think that's why, it's probably why some people have found it difficult to imagine a situation where they had an unearned advantage. So that happens a lot. And the other thing that I've observed and also noticed is that when we want to talk about something as sensitive as this, we find language that is appropriate because we don't want to hurt somebody, and because we don't want to stand in a situation where we have to justify ourselves, and we miss the point. In my opinion, if you don't say something the way it is, then you always get this prolonged conversation because you give everybody the chance to argue and defend themselves and protect themselves, and that is what I see a lot about going around this conversation of racism, not only here, but around other places that I've seen that conversation happen. And until we are bold enough, I believe, and ready to say it the way it is, and stand the chance of being blamed, being ostracized, and called all sorts of names, that conversation will go for a very long time. It has been going. I mean, we're talking something over 500 years. I don't think that when racism started, people were not talking about it. So we're talking about it. But this conversation has gone for over 500 years, and it's still going. We're still sitting here, and going around it, you know, going into in the circles and making it go forever and ever. But I think those are some of the issues that we need to look at when we want to talk about racism. Is racism, is sexism, is homophobia, is xenophobia, is the gender issues. These are issues that are there. They're in society, they're part of us. And if we don't point out those issues and talk about them, they will continue to drag on and on.
So even if we get the words wrong, even if we don't have quite the right vocabulary now, it's best to just face it directly, right on.
Use the vocabulary that we have.
That's an awesome point.
Say, this is the language we have, let us use it.
Okay, well, yeah, and maybe people of color isn't the right term to use, but at least it moves the conversation down the track a little bit, even if it's the wrong term. Then we talk to each other, and then we say, well, maybe that is the right term. Then we come up with a new term, and then we've moved the conversation forward, as you're saying. Thank you.
That's what I think.
I think it's more than that sometimes, though. I mean, we're really tender about this, so we tend to equivocate in how we talk about it. And I think there's something valuable about the bluntness of some people of color just saying what it is.
And not worrying about white fragility.
Yeah.
If you know, that takes a lot of guts for somebody of color to talk to a white audience and risk the backlash. Yes, sir.
There's a video out there that you can tap that's free. It's only about 3 minutes. But to buy the video will cost $650. But the video is called Ouch. And the video Ouch is for a closed group. I work for the federal government. I'm an executive, 1,200 employees. Every employee in my agency saw this video. And the video Ouch was used to have a discussion. And all it had in incorporation of the video were individuals with all the different things that Willie just talked about, all those different groups. And words were used which were very negative in nature. The purpose was, if somebody says something in our group, so it's your group, our organization, that anyone does not appreciate, anyone can use the word, ouch. And when they say that, that gives you an opportunity to say, what did I say? Or what did I do? Or we now can have a discussion around that because it's a safe word to use that word, ouch. But if you're not part of the environment that knows that's what we're doing in our culture, you can't just say that for society. But you can use that at a school, or you can use that at your church, or you can use that in the work environment and say, that's okay that we can do that. I had a Hispanic, I'm from Minnesota, I have 23 states, I had a Hispanic woman in Texas, and I said something, and she said the word, oh, I don't want to do what I just did and done. Okay? I didn't, I was ignorant, but I had to keep educated there.
It was
very helpful. Made me a better person as a result.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Thank you for the resource. Ouch. The name of the video is Ouch. Thank you.
But being, sorry to prolong it, but being from another culture, really, and only relatively recently having some experience here, maybe you don't know what a lot of us whiteys have been through with trying to find the appropriate term for, what is it now, an Aboriginal? Native American, Indian, Savage.
First people.
First people, yeah. Like that whole routine of going, getting a term that we think is comfortable to use and then having it slapped down and coming up with another one and having that slapped down and still trying to find something that is appropriate and not offensive, but never being able to, it seems.
We're on our way. I mean, that's what sanctification is all about. Maybe we'll never get to the mountaintop, but we keep trying. And hopefully we won't take too much offense.
We even have this in the Bible. You see, I was following the session about Psalms yesterday, And sections of the sound that I just told you, never pronounced, because they're pointing at some really straight things that people are uncomfortable talking about.
Yes.
So this is a conversation that has been going on for long. I don't think that we need to continue to do that if we actually want to contribute to moving that conversation forward.
Yeah. I do want to leave you with some what to do, because that's what I was dinged mostly on my workshop last year, and maybe I didn't do a great job with it, but I do want to leave you with some things. Where do we go from here? And I have mentioned this author before, E.G. Oluo. So when you want to talk about race, it's one of my book recommendations, just came out in June. She says, vote local for those who make racial justice a priority. Get in schools. This is my realm, and I gather a couple of other people. Get to know what the curriculum says. And if it doesn't say anything about race, be a parent that advocates for it. Talk to teachers, and social studies teachers perhaps mostly, who teach this stuff in history or don't. Has your school board made a statement about the rights of all students? Maybe it might seem a little superficial, but our school district just made a statement about its position with ICE when it comes into the district. We will protect our students. What is the racial achievement gap in your district? Might be interesting to find out what that is. How many students of color get put in detention? How many students of color get suspended? Those are good things to know. Bear witness. When a person of color is being harassed or followed in your store, offer help when it's safe to do so. And I say this with a little trepidation just because there is this other concept of being a white savior, and you don't want to be that person who steps in and says, well, I vouch for this person, so let me help that person. You know, life isn't perfect. You just got to move forward in the way that seems appropriate and right at the time. If a person of color is being harassed in the store and you recognize it, maybe talk to the store owner after the incident and then just say, maybe when the incident is over and that kind of thing, maybe just say, that wasn't appropriate. I saw what happened and it's not okay. If it feels good to you. Maybe if it doesn't feel good to you. Okay. Speak up in your union if you belong to one. I do. Anybody belong to a union in here? A couple of them. Yeah, no, they're going away. I get that. But leverage your membership to keep equity and inclusion in the spotlight. Support people of color owned businesses. Shop at businesses. On my phone, we used to live in St. Louis. And anybody else live in St. Louis or ever been passed through there? There is an organization there. There's the white pages, there's the yellow pages, and there's the black pages. Somebody took it on themselves to come up with all of the businesses that are out there that are black owned and put it on an app. I got it right here. It's called the Black Pages. When we lived there in the 90s, it wasn't obviously on an app, but maybe in your city, start a campaign to come up with all the names of the black businesses and start going there, shopping at those businesses. Become a tester. We have something called the Fair Housing Council in Portland. Is that in other cities too? I'm assuming it's nationwide. This organization it does lots of things, but among them is to see if there's discrimination in housing so that white people and people of color can go through can contact the same agent, be shown a house, and report on their experiences. I haven't gotten the courage up yet to do it myself. It takes some time, and you write a report up, you go through a training and that kind of thing, but I'm assuming there's a Fair Housing Council in large cities where you may live. Check it out. If you'd like to, if you think that that's an appropriate way to address racism in your area, become a tester. Boycott lenders who prey on people of color, and this might take a little bit of research, lending practices, higher interest rates for people of color, redlining, price fixing, things that disadvantage people of color. It continues to happen. I won't mention the name of Wells Fargo, but there are organizations out there that have used inappropriate lending practices. Oakland being one example, Baltimore being another example. Now, I'll also say that life is never clean. This is Claudia Rankin's book. She,
right at the beginning of the book, she thanks all the people who sponsored this book, helped her publish it, and there's Wells Fargo right there. So, I mean, I'm not going to put down Wells Fargo. So, but I just did. I know. But life is messy. Got to go for the things that need fixing and maybe praise the things that don't, that are going well. All right, donate to organizations that fight racial oppression. The ACLU, NAACP, Southern Poverty Law Center, the Center for Arab American Relations, National Immigrant Justice Center, and the list is endless. Use those end-of-the-year donations or the regular throughout-the-year donations to support organizations that fight racial oppression and support communities of color. Boycott businesses that exploit workers of color. Again, this is going to take a little bit of research. Support music, film, TV, art, books. Support black art. Support Native American art. Support Asian. Support art of all different kinds. And if it's not represented in your local museum, ask for it. Say, I don't see this color, this ethnic group being represented. Well, can you make sure that art gets put into this museum? Support increases in minimum wages. Push your mayor and city council for police reform. Demand school, college diversity. Demand the diversity and inclusiveness of students, curriculum, and staff. Yeah, that's a problem in my school. You don't have to wait till you college for this one. All the teachers in my school are white. If you're a teacher or if you're a parent and it should concern you, go to the principal and say, I noticed that all the teachers are white in this school. Have you considered hiring a person of color? Or are there any people of color who are even applying? Have you sought out people of color? Because I noticed that your students are mostly students of color. And maybe they should have a teacher of color that they come to from time to time, as an example. I say that as an indictment against myself, because that's my school. And Robin DiAngelo, whom I've mentioned several times in the course of our time here, she's all about listening. First thing is just listen. Decenter yourself. Decenter whiteness, whenever possible. And educate yourself, as you've thankfully been doing over the last 3 days. This, what you've been doing the last 3 days, is an act of anti-racism. And you've become a change agent, even in the last couple of days, whether you've decided to or not, because you're now more educated than you were 3-4 days ago. Well, I think that's about all I've got. Anybody want to make some comments here?
Yeah, there's a guy named David Kampf, C-A-M-P-F. He has come to Fort Lewis a couple times. He's a black guy, and he gives seminars on how to like convert people in your circle. You know, because he says, like, who are your 30 closest people or 50 closest people? Somewhere in there, are there any people who you know kind of close to that are, you know, kind of struggling with racism or, you know, kind of on the opposite fence? And that those are the people ideally we, you know, how do you talk to them when you go home for Thanksgiving or family gatherings or something? How do you talk to these people? And he has what I think a lot of people emphasize, real non-confrontational approach, the idea being that if you attack someone, they're just going to close up immediately and there's no hope of reaching them then, you know. So he says the first thing that you want to do is try to find a way to connect with them, even if they complain about something, like, you know, that person, they barely speak in English. Why can't they speak English? You say, yeah, I know, I had a really hard time understanding my waiter's accent the other day. It was terrible, you know, I didn't know what he was saying. But then, so after you've made this connection, then you say something like, but you know, when I was in Mexico and I didn't speak Spanish and they were so patient and kind waiting for me, you know, to help me understand. And every time, you know, so it just makes me, I really understand how vulnerable you can feel, and I really am patient with those people because of whatever. Or something like that. There's like a little, you know, process to follow where you can connect with them and then suggest a different point of view. And it's never in the attacking mode that's just going to turn them off and create more conflict. But
David,
if he comes around, you know, keep your eyes and ears out for him. He was really great. And
David,
he's on, you can Google him too. He's on like NPR and stuff like that as well. So.
Anything you want to add to the list we've just come up with or make a comment? Yeah.
About the media one, just having that, maybe because there's a flourishing of voices of people of color, African Americans, I think are maybe especially, anyway, like the movie Black Panther, I feel like it changes my consciousness because it's pretty evident that African American communities were, like, had a kind of deep happiness about it. So then for me to see that, I saw something I'd never seen before, like, oh, I kind of get the difference now between a movie that kind of maybe is about black people or for black people versus one that in a deeper way was kind of a change in our culture. And I don't know, just, and then you learn more about how politically aware people of color talk about themselves and terms they use, and you get a more sense of the subtleties. Maybe it helps me see people less in terms of race and more in terms of the spectrum of creativity and diversity within each of the people.
Yeah.
So it's not just about like doing it for an act of justice, but actually like my own act of joy and consciousness changing.
Excellent.
So I think it's important when you're talking and discussing things like race and stuff about culture is to remember that a lot of people will agree with you on race that you shouldn't do it. But then you talk about any other thing, and they will disagree with you because they have different political mindset. They're from different parties. So I think it's important to remember we can agree on this one thing, but we don't have to agree on anything else. This is our issue. Because I'm a pretty strong conservative, and I'm here because I believe we shouldn't have racism, right? But like, I will admit, like most of people, I would disagree on a lot of other things, issues that we have. So I think it's important to remember, you don't have to agree on things. Agree on other things, but when you come down and sit down on an issue, you have. They agree on this, and so that's what's important. We don't have to worry about anything else. Don't worry about what your opinions are on other issues.
Thank you.
One of the things I scratch my head about is, I mean, I can look at myself and see the privilege that I have, okay? But then to have a conversation about what do I need to do to level the playing field for other people? I mean, do I use my wealth to change things? And if I start talking about that, I get kind of scared.
Yes.
I mean, the whole idea of reparations, that, and I know a lot of the people that are colleagues of mine would just kind of freak out at that. Is it my responsibility to do that on my own? Or is it the government's responsibility to do it or somebody else? I don't know.
Yeah, Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about that concept of reparations. It's a scary one because that's our livelihood. And we worked hard to get where we are right now. Not a single person in this room did not work hard to get where they are right now. And by no fault of your own are you wealthy, but we also need to recognize that we live in a system that favors us. So is it something you're... are we being asked to give up something?
Mm-hmm.
We're Christians.
Yeah.
I would encourage us to think also about getting out of our comfort zones. I know a lot of congregations, particularly Lutheran congregations, well, we want to be more diverse. We want more people to be people of color to be in our congregation. I would argue it's we should be going to other congregations to listen, to learn, to be part of them. It's important for us to think about, so the last person that was hired at your congregation, your faith community, what effort did your faith community make to ensure that that was a person of color? Did you get candidates? And if you didn't, did you say, well, hold on, time out. We obviously aren't living out what we're trying to accomplish. How do we start to say, well, if we only get people that look like us, there's something about privilege going on there. How do we start to challenge ourselves and say, is there another way? Do we have to think out of the box about becoming who we hope to be?
And it's, I don't think you're saying that you just have, it's important to hire a person of color simply because they're a person of color. That's not what you're saying. But if you have an organization that has 20 people hired and they're all white, there's a problem there. Okay. Yes, sir.
I just, I recently read a book that I would commend to people. It's called Waking Up White.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
By,
great book.
Yeah. And it's from the author's perspective about growing up in a upper middle class family in New England, and but being a progressive family, and she wants to make a difference with social justice, but she keeps hitting these barriers along the way. She realizes it's because she doesn't realize her own whiteness, and so it's kind of her personal journey to kind of get over that while still working to do something for racial justice. I think it was really helpful for me.
It's kind of it's a great book.
Yeah.
Waking Up White is the name of it. And on along that lines, I've got another little goodie here. No extra charge. This is a freebie.
Ice cream, if you wish. But if you want to think about what white culture is, it's possible to kind of separate and tease out aspects of white culture. So that's what this is. It's from the Dismantling Racism Workshop website. It's available online, but I've made hard copies for you. If you wish, you feel free to take it. Book recommendations here also. This is just a drop in the ocean of all the books that are out there by which you can educate yourself. Let's close our time with prayer. Gracious and loving God, thank you for these 3 days, these 6 short hours. Thank you for the time to help us all become educated, to learn from one another, to be vulnerable, to accept and expect non-closure, to be confidential, to be honest, to use words we're not sure about, to risk being embarrassed, to risk embarrassing ourselves. But this is how we move the conversation forward. If we're not honest, the train will stay in the station, and we need to move it out. Thank you for inspiring us to move forward. Thank you for the liberals, the conservatives, the progressives, whatever labels people live under. Thank you for them all coming here in this room, in the world, however they may work, to move forward this issue of racism, because it hurts us all. Thank you for your redeeming power and the promise of redemption for all. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Thank you all.